Well, I'm Jim Adelstein. I've spent most of my career at the Harvard Medical School. I first met Burt Valley in 1948 when we were both at MIT. He was a postdoctoral fellow of the same preceptor that I was as an undergraduate, a man named John Loughborough. We immediately found a kinship, even though there was this almost 10-year difference between us. Unfortunately, Professor Loughborough died shortly after we'd met each other, and Burt invited me in my last year at MIT to join his laboratory for a summer job. So I've known him basically since 1948.
What was your impression of him when you first met him? Can you think back to what it was like to meet him then?
Well, he seemed to me to be a rather intense individual who was really set on creating a life in science for himself. But at the same time, he was able to relate well to other people, and particularly to involve them in his social as well as professional ambience.
How did your lives connect? What were the interweaving points during those years of the 50s and the 60s, scientifically?
Yes. I did spend the summer of 1949 working in his laboratory, and then went off to medical school and spent the summer after my first year at medical school in his laboratory as well. So he was working on the development of analytical methods for looking at trace elements, which was his primary interest, one that he had developed during the Second World War when he had worked with Edwin Cohn and John Edsel on blood preservation work. He then realized that he needed to know more chemistry. He had needed to develop analytical methods, and my work with him was in part to help with building one of those. After I graduated from medical school and did a year of internship, I decided I would like to go back to science and to combine a scientific career with one in medicine. And he encouraged me to return to MIT to finish my PhD degree and to work in his laboratory for my dissertation. So I became his first graduate student. So in some ways, that's a sort of signal place that I may have had in his career. Burt was very generous. In the course of my pursuing graduate work, he sponsored me on a trip to Europe been in 1954, to go to what I think may have been the first International Biochemistry Congress in Brussels. And before that Congress, he invited me to meet him and his wife, Natalie, who everyone called Cookie, in Pontresina in Switzerland, and spend some time there walking in the woods. I remember that time very particularly because we had some very deep conversations, very philosophical ones about science in general, about science and medicine, and about career planning in science. Of course, I was enough younger than him that I didn't quite have the perspective that he had. So it was both a very pleasant circumstance, and it was quite an educational one for me.
Can you remember some of the key points that he made, or a few of them anyway, about the life in science that he led and that he was talking about with you?
Yes. Well, he understood that the development of science depended a great deal upon having the technology to answer some of the questions that were before him. And since he was interested in trace elements, of course, the first thing that he was interested in was developing the technology for the analysis of trace elements. That idea stayed with him pretty much throughout his scientific life, and he was the first one to employ a number of scientific instruments in pursuit of the kind of work that he was doing. So that was a sort of general phenomenon. Also, he was interested in the community of scientists, an idea that finally gave expression to this foundation that he had. He had no illusions, however. He knew that science could be both competitive and collaborative, and we talked quite a bit about how one would be able to discern which individuals were likely to be friendly and others who were likely to be more selfish.
Were there particular traits that he could point to that would say this person is going to be a collaborative scientist or not?
I don't think he gave me any fingerprints that let me decide one or the other. But that was certainly something that had come up in conversation. And I will say that in the course of his career, he divided people pretty much into those who were genuinely collaborative and cooperative scientists, not necessarily just with him, but in general, and those who were what he would consider to be much more self-indulgent.
What do you think led him to the importance of collaboration in his career? Was there something about his earlier life, his education? Because I'm hearing that again and again, that it's obviously a key point and an important part of the foundation, but it seems to have been manifested itself earlier on as well.
Well, in the following way, he and Kuki had no children, so they traveled every summer in those days when people had summer holidays. They don't seem to do that anymore. But he would travel to various scientific institutions. Sometimes he would spend time working there. He worked in the Carlsberg labs in Denmark for a while. He had developed collaborations with scientists at the Karolinska in Stockholm, and he particularly had an affinity for the inorganic chemistry department at Oxford. So he had rather international collaboratives, and he loved to travel around and visit with them, not only to do science, but also to participate in more social activities. I think that was in the back of his mind when in the 1990s he asked a group of us to accompany him on sort of a mini retreat in Vermont to think about what he might do with some of the assets that he had accumulated. I think both the combination of not having children to spend money on and the fact that he'd had some outside consultancies and had a very wise money manager had given him more assets than most people generally had who were in his circumstance. And I recall that we talked a lot about how to convert his interest in travel and in scientific collaboration in some meaningful, substantive way. And out of that came the idea that perhaps what we ought to do is sponsor international visits between scientists. And then the question was, what's the context for doing that? Well, we all agreed that if you paid for a trip that lasted 2 or 3 days, you got a very nice meal out of it, and you gave a lecture, but it wasn't the basis of any longstanding cooperative venture. On the other hand, by the time we had thought about this was in the 1990s, the idea of a scientist who had a large laboratory taking a sabbatical was just not in the cards any longer. So we thought, well, maybe a month would be enough time if somebody could embed themselves in a laboratory, find somebody who would take them in and who was interested in working with them. So that became the first program, and I think is still the central program of the foundation, because that created a fellowship of scientists that really is the glue that binds the organization together. Once a number of those visits had taken place, we said, well, maybe we ought to gather everybody together in a kind of fellowship. And the first meeting began. And the first meeting again was not thematic as this meeting is now, but rather were reports from the Valley visiting professors about their science. And sometimes they were things that Bert reflected on. For example, he had come as the first League of Nations, I think the only fellow sponsored by them in 1939. When he came to the United States, a mathematician at NYU, who I think was part of the group that was sponsoring scientists, named Courant, quite a famous mathematician, became his mentor. And he learned that Bert was not interested just in biology, but he was interested in medicine as well, and led him through what we would now consider to be the pre-medical curriculum at the New York University, and then saw to it that he had the wherewithal to apply to medical school there. And that actually was the beginning of his formal education in the United States.
What was he like as a teacher, as a professor?
I heard that he had rather, that he was a bit of a showman in terms of offering his expertise when he was a professor.
No question that he was a showman. I mean, when he would prepare a lecture, he would, and we didn't have PowerPoint in those days, it took him forever to get his slides finally in the order that he wanted to. And he had a good command of, an excellent command of English, despite the fact that it wasn't his first language. So his lectures were very amusing as well as informative. He was a bear when it came to writing. Manuscripts had to be written over and over and over again until he was absolutely satisfied that they were correct. He had an interesting combination. In some ways, he was extremely generous. In other ways, he was extremely demanding. So I remember in the laboratory on Thursday, we all went out for a very convivial dinner with lots of humor and jokes being told. And then we went back to the laboratory. And that was, it was almost a court-martial in terms of your presenting your material and seeing that it was absolutely right. So he had these two sides of him. But I think that was all done in aid of encouraging people in their careers and seeing they were doing very well.
It sounds as though he didn't do things by halves, either in terms of his own work or in his enjoyment of life or in his looking after students and getting the best out of the ones that he had there at the laboratory.
No, he didn't. And, of course, you have to remember that, first of all, he was very a productive scientist, and his work on metalloenzymes and metalloproteins is absolutely first rate. And that earned him all sorts of honors of one kind or another. On the other hand, there were two other aspects of his professional life, which we talk about in his memoir. One is that he was part of one of the first industrial academic relationships. And, you know, people were rather critical about this. They thought that the academic world would be somewhat contaminated by that kind of an arrangement. This was with the Monsanto company. And it was very interesting in how it came about. He was a consultant to them because they're an agricultural company. And trace metals in the feed of animals turns out to be very important. For example, Australia, you can't raise cattle or sheep without knowing something about trace metal nutrition. So he was a consultant to them. And somewhere along the line, one of the vice presidents had decided that the Monsanto might extend itself out of agricultural work into life sciences and wanted a sort of window into contemporary life sciences. So they came to Bert and talked to him. And Bert at that time was working with a scientist named Judah Folkman, who was very much interested in angiogenesis, new vessel formation in cancer. And what they decided to do was to try to isolate from cancer cells the substances that produce these new blood vessels. To do that, they needed to have large amounts of cancer cells grown in vitro. And of course, Monsanto had the technology from their fermentation stuff to grow these enormous amounts. So basically, the deal was that Monsanto would grow the cancer cells and send the medium from the cancer cells to Bert and Folkman, and they would then proceed to isolate materials from it. Now, there were two aspects of it that I thought were rather interesting. First was they realized that they would have to demonstrate in some ways that there was no collusion in this thing. And so the contract that they drew up between them had some very substantial language in it, including the formation of an outside advisory committee that would look to see that the relationships between the two were well taken. Another thing is they really did get quite a bit for the university out of this. They had part of a building was built and three professorships were added onto it. So in addition to the money that paid for the research, there was actually some institutional support that went on and above that. I think that worked out fairly well. They both began to isolate various elements from the soup that had been sent from Monsanto, and then Monsanto decided it sort of ended. They were less interested in continuing, and by that time they had built up their life science program, but they then went ahead and abandoned it, went back to agricultural interest.
But in setting up that relationship with Monsanto, is that an indication? In a way, he was a bit of an iconoclast. He would try new things, even if it was going to ruffle things up a little bit in terms
absolutely.
Of...
He was fearless about that, and he was less... He didn't mind a certain amount of behavior, turbulence. And if he... As a matter of fact, and he was known as a kind of iconoclast. He tells a story that when he was called to the dean's office, who wanted to present him with a named professorship, and George Berry said to Bert, "I'm going to give you the Cabot professorship." Bert said, "I'm speechless." And George Berry said, "That's a triumph of mine." No, and he would do little things. Like, for example, for a reason not clear, the Harvard Medical School resisted having an MD-PhD program well after some other schools had started. He thought it was a good idea. And so he chaired the committee to try to make it happen. The committee was divided. He discovered that the opposition were people who like to have long weekends. So he decided the committee would meet late Friday afternoon so that he was able to put that over on them. Now, of course, the third thing that he did was when Edgar Bronfman was approached to see whether he would donate money for a building at the old Peter Bent Brigham Hospital. Bronfman said, "No, I'm not interested in building buildings." But Bronfman's physician seemed to have known Bert and said, "Well, how about using Bert's interest in alcohol metabolism in some way that might be useful in searching for a medical treatment for alcoholism?" And they got on fine about that. In actual fact, something came out of it, although it's not yet completely worked out, but he had working in his laboratory a chap from China who was training as a biochemist, but he knew something about traditional Chinese medicine. And he knew that there was a medicine that had been used to sort of fend off alcoholism in China, which came from a very common plant, kudzu, which is, as you know, an invasive plant. And they worked very hard to get material from that and demonstrated in animals that they could break both hamsters and rats that had been trained to favor alcohol over water to become alcohol averse. And that line of interest is being pursued still at the present moment by an industrial group. So, he wasn't just interested in biochemistry of metals.
So he was an outstanding scientist, a generous figure.
Yes.
But also he seems to have been someone who enjoyed life very much. Is that something that rings true when you think about it?
Well, he certainly, yes, that he had some passions for a number of things. He loved to go horseback riding in the West, particularly in Montana. He had a terrific desired to have white asparagus in May, and we sponsored a number of trips to Strasbourg and Alsace in order to fulfill that interest of his. And he was very, very jolly on social occasions of one kind or another. like to sing. But
did he like to sing?
Well, sort of bawdy songs. I think he learned when he was a student at the University of Bern.
Now, if he was to walk through the door now and see what had developed from this foundation that took up in 1996, what do you think his impression would be, for example, of this meeting 2014 in Boston?
Well, the board of directors tries to think about what he would like, not be completely taken by that. I think he would enjoy seeing how the fellowship has grown. I think he would obviously understand that it no longer can just be people who are his friend, but that concept has actually preserved. I think that would be the thing he would be most proud of. I think he would approve of some of the new programs. For example, the sponsorship of young postdocs to come to the Lindau meeting that Eddie Fisher has proposed that we do. So I think the small number of us that still remember him and still remember what his interests are trying to fulfill what they would be. And I think he would enjoy the scientific meeting. I mean, I think he'd be proud of that, the fact that it is now matured into something of that quality.